But being the time of year that we're in right now, basically in the middle of that period of time between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost, we haven't left the situation where we are to evaluate ourselves. You know, that is part of the process of preparing for the Passover, that we examine ourselves. Today I want to pose an even broader examination, because it's not just personal, but it's also, we could say, denominational. We do have a denomination. We don't like to use, in the past we haven't liked to use that word, but it is a fact. But I want us to assess our personal responsiveness, because it's part of living God's way. How do we do? There are people in the mainstream religions who take the approach that basically God has done it all for us. We don't really need to do all that much. Now, that belief system is not that old. It's come to the fore more in the modern era. People back in the 1700s and so on wouldn't have explained things the way that people do today. But people are of the opinion that, you know, once God calls you, once you're converted, you can basically float. Don't need to do much of anything at all. God's doing it all for you. In a sense, that's true. But in another sense, it can be dangerous. And that's what I want us to think about today. That idea gives people a sense of complacency. They figure that all they have to do is attend services, to sit in the audience, to hear what's said, and that's fine. That's enough. Well, I suppose for someone who has no talents and no cognitive abilities, I suppose, what else can they do? But I don't believe that is the consensus among the people that God has chosen to call. Now, that idea can also be reflected in an organizational environment. The idea that you don't need to do anything, it will all be done for you. The ministry will take care of everything. That comes to the fore from time to time. And we need to keep in mind what it can do to a person's initiative. The church will do it all for you. Well, in the right church, perhaps, but we don't always have a perfect spiritual environment in our various congregations. And I'm speaking more in-house, not so much this group, but having the chance to visit other congregations, there's kind of a reflection on old memories that perhaps are good to think about and keep in mind. Because it brings us around to the basic question, what does God expect of us? You see, He's made an investment in each of us. When He gives us His Spirit, it can be like a seed. It's something that's expected to germinate and to grow. He's invested in us. He has an interest in that investment. No one is called to just be there. He gave His disciples instructions, "Go you into all the world and preach the gospel." They could have all just attended Sabbath services together for the rest of their lives. It's not what God wanted of them. How much of that carries over to us? One of the conditions that we find in our church today is the thing called exclusivism. And we run into it all the time. For some reason, when people supposedly have God's Spirit, see it appropriate to hold other people who have God's Spirit in a certain arm's length relationship. Why would anyone who has God's Spirit do that with anyone else who has God's Spirit? Based primarily on their choice of affiliation. Some people don't have a choice. They have what they have in their area, and that's what they have to deal with. Here in this area, we're blessed that there's more than one organization out there. Some places in the world, there isn't another one for 200-300 miles. So you can't necessarily fault someone for their choice of affiliation. But what we can fault ourselves for is when someone has God's Spirit, who believes basically, if not entirely, as we do, why would we hold them in some degree of disdain? This is the area we need to be thinking about. And it reflects back to what I just asked. What does God expect of us? Some of the separateness we see in our various groups is not based on doctrinal matters all that much. It's more the aura of organizational loyalty. And many times organizations, they don't say it directly, but they sort of imply that our salvation is dependent upon our remaining loyal to their particular group. That idea originated, I can safely say, at least 40 years ago, maybe more. And it's carried forward into many of our modern day groups, divided as we are. I'm not saying we should be. But it's happened. And it's our condition today. Many people find security being within a particular fold, a particular organization. They're afraid to step out. They're afraid to step away. They're afraid to read anybody else's literature or attend with any other congregation. We can understand that based on our culture. But is it what God really wants of people who share the same Spirit? Supposedly, that's the idea. And I don't doubt that's the condition in many cases. But why is there that standoffishness? That's what we need to factor in to the answer to that question. What does God expect of us? Back to my opening premise, where some people take the approach that God has done it all for us, we don't need to do anything. Well, that can carry forward into organizational environments as well. That can reflect also the God will do it all for us syndrome. We should have that to a degree, but with clear circumspection, which means looking around and evaluating the situation in a practical and in a positive way. Is there any aspect of that that is detrimental to faith? It can be. We have situations, and we've had it for many years, and you run into this right and left, that the growth environment can be very suppressive. Very suppressive. There are people who lead various groups, and I can name you a couple of two or three primaries that don't want their people to develop their spiritual senses. They want them to remain quiet, basically taking no initiative, basically doing almost nothing. And you have to wonder, is God pleased with that? Leave it all to the leadership. That's fine. In certain administrative areas, that's entirely appropriate. But I'm talking about spiritual growth. I'm talking about doing what God wants us, each of us, personally, to do. A suppressive growth environment is not a healthy environment for spiritual growth. We have situations where great damage has been done to a congregation. Reflecting on our history back east, I could name you a number of leaders in that group who did repetitive damage to that congregation. There was 125 people every week at one time. From what I'm gathering, there's almost nothing left. Why? Who did that? I think it's because people didn't exercise their senses of discernment, like Hebrews 4 talks about. Their senses of discernment to see what was going on and to act appropriately. God has called each and every one of us with an expectation that when He gives us of His Spirit, we will use it, we will employ it as He wishes. I mean, it's His Spirit after all. A question that often comes up, and I've had this conversation many times, particularly with one person, but it can be, I'm sure it's in the mind of others. When they think of another group, they ask the question, are they part of the body? It's a profound question when you think about it. Other groups who believe largely as we do, maybe there's some, you know, variation of thought, there always will be. Variations of an understanding. Variations in their focus on who and what they are and what they're doing. I understand, there's some of that. But what is our attitude toward like believers? That's where I want us to consider. Are these other groups part of the body? There are some who struggle with that question because they're not fully comfortable with the answer, yes. Now let's think about it. In Bible study, we went through Revelation 2 and 3, and we sort of read through each of the seven distinct and separate congregations with their own characteristics, their own problems, their own positive aspects. They were all different. Were any of them not part of the body? Even the ones that have the negative assessment, were they not part of the body? That's not for us to determine entirely. I mean, we can use certain discretion when we see things that are really wrong. But when someone has God's Spirit, are they part of the body? And is the answer to that dependent on who they choose for an affiliation? Now, I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir here, but I don't know that I'm not saying that's our problem. But when you see other groups, when you are with other groups who have their own organizational structure, it can be a problem. What is our regard for the greater fellowship? And what should we do in and among and around those. In Luke 17:10, we are confronted with a disturbing assessment. Luke 17:10. And this is speaking to people who think they're in good shape. They may be. They may not. But their personal assessment is somewhat upset by what he says here. Because there are many people who are doing everything they're supposed to be doing, so far as they know. But Jesus said, "So likewise you, when you shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do." Think about it if you're an employer. You hire someone. You expect them to do the job. And they do the job well enough to earn their pay. But it doesn't make any profit to the company because all of their efforts go into their paycheck. There's nothing left over to accrue to the company's accounts. What you could say is this is somebody who's done all that they're required to do, but they haven't done anything that makes them profitable. Can anything like that reflect on ourselves? Let's go over to Hebrews 13:17. Hebrews 13. This is interesting in another sense. Obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls, as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. So there's another component here, that we need to be working with the leadership. But let's turn that around. What does the leadership doing? Here's where we may have been deficient in the past, which may account for our current situation that, in my opinion, is far more divided than it ever should have been. But we have what we have, and we have to work with it, and we have to figure out what's wrong with that in a way that we can reverse the situation. God tells us that we should know them, and this is talking about the leadership, we should know them by their fruits. How do you do that if you never evaluate them? Okay? Can you see what's embedded in that statement? We have a responsibility. We should be watching out for the health and welfare of the congregation, because the congregation is made up of people who have God's Spirit. And when something happens, when something is done that injures the individual or injures the whole congregation, and I could tell you stories about that. I've seen a lot of it. What do we do? Now, one of the things we saw in our review of the seven churches of Asia Minor in the first two chapters of Revelation, one of the first things we saw in there was the Ephesian church took it upon themselves to evaluate their apostles. And they found some of them to be false. Imagine that. What did they do about it? False apostles were in positions of leadership, let's say at least, in various congregations. They had an influence upon people. When they discerned that they were false, what did they do? Did they keep it to themselves? Or did they exercise their spiritual discernment as God required they do? No doubt they made it known. For a time it worked. But in time, that faded. They lost it. They got away from doing that. And what happened? Within a couple hundred years, two or three or four generations, it all faded. The false apostles stayed in, even up to the point in time when Jezebel, that prophetess, taught the churches to do wrong things. She was still there by then. The people, at first, fulfilled their responsibility to know them by their fruits. And we need to do that ourselves. There are fruits that are positive, and there are fruits that are not. What do we do? What does God expect of us? Unleavened bread symbolizes a quality. I think we know that. We don't just put leaven out, but we take unleavenedness in. And what is the source of that unleavenedness? Of course, it's God's Spirit as He gives it to us. And to do what with it? There was an interesting thing that happened in last week's Bible study. And I think it's going to trigger another message. I can pretty much guarantee you it's going to trigger another message. But we were discussing, how do we present the differences in our belief system to someone in some other religion in this world? One of the things that we should point out, you know, we tend to go to the Sabbath and holy days. Well, those are obviously contrasting differences. But one of the things that we should point out to people is that the world, for the most part, operates under a misdefined grace. They've defined what grace is incorrectly. But someone in the group thought I was saying mystifying grace. Now that is beautiful. Okay, like I say, there's going to be a message coming. Mystifying grace, because that's what it is, but that isn't really what I was trying to say. But grace has been extended to us. We know that, but do we realize the extent of it? We are given grace, and most people conceive of grace as an incoming thing. God has graciously pardoned our sins, taken them from us. We no longer have to pay the penalty. And that's somewhat the support structure for people who think that God has done it all for us. Well, in that respect, yeah. But there's more to it. Because, you see, grace is not just an incoming phenomenon. Grace is also something that we ought to be exhibiting in our lives. Let's look at a few places. John 1:16. And this has an overlay on where I started with this message. How do we assess our relationship with like believers who just happen to be of a different affiliation? John 1:16. And of his fullness have all we received, and grace for grace. Now that's an odd word structure. We have received grace for grace. Do you understand what that means? I'm not sure that it's that apparent. But I'm posing to you that we receive grace, but we are to use it to extend it to others. 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15. We'll build on this. My pages don't stick together. 1 Corinthians 15. Verse 10. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace, which was bestowed upon me, was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God, which was with me. So Paul's labors were the fruit of the grace that he had received. God's grace was what empowered his works. 2 Corinthians 6, verse 1. We then, as workers together with him, okay? What makes that possible? We workers together with him beseech you also that you receive not the grace of God in vain. Grace has its incoming aspect, but it also has its responsibility to project over a page onto 2 Corinthians 8, 7. Therefore, as you abound in everything, in faith and utterance and knowledge and in all diligence and in your love to us, see that you abound in this grace also. Abounding in that grace to what effect? It empowers faith. It facilitates utterance, what we say. It facilitates what we know, and presumably we share what we know. And in all diligence and love to us, that is where we are to abound. Over another page, 2 Corinthians 9:8. 9:8. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. That's how we put grace to use. Colossians 4:6. Colossians 4, let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. God's grace factors into how we approach and how we interact with other people. We're told we're to grow in grace. How do you grow in grace if it's just incoming only? Now that growth is a result of use, how we exhibit it. It's outgoing as well as incoming. Let's look at 1 Peter 4:10. 1 Peter 4:10. As every man has received the gift, even so minister the same one to another, as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. We're given something that should have many faceted expressions. It was a couple of months ago I gave a message on living in the Spirit. In this message I want to focus on using the Spirit. John 7:38. And this describes, I think, what God expects of those people in whom He has invested His Spirit. It says, "He that believes on Me, as the Scripture has said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living waters." That's a word picture that should express what God's people will be doing. They're going to be a positive influence in their field of contact. Hebrews 1:14, another factor that's important to consider. We're not alone in this. We're not out there hanging by our fingernails in a hostile world. Hebrews 1:14, very important component. I'm going to start in about verse 12 just to carry the word flow through. "And as a vesture shall you fold them up, and they shall be changed. But you are the same, and thy years shall not fail. But to which of the angels said he at any time, 'Sit on my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool'?" Referring to Psalm 110. Speaking of the angels, are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? Those people who God has called, in whom He has invested His Spirit, have an angelic overseer working with us. And when we're doing what God wants us to do, we have additional help as needed. Something we need to keep in mind. Our future is already assigned to us, presuming that we carry through faithfully to the end. It's a thing called predestination. Unfortunately, the world has confused the issue big time on what that word means. It merely means that our destiny is predetermined. God has a plan. He's working that plan. It doesn't mean that some are predestined to be called, some are not. That's a whole different issue. The thing is, what are we to become? And it says that we are to be conformed to the likeness of His Son. We can alter our future assignment. We can make it better. We can make it worse. Depends on what we do, how we respond to God's leadership, how we use what He has given us. Not just sitting, doing nothing. That's not what He expects of His living Spirit in us. Matthew 16:27. I want to go there. And I'm not going to look at that clock, so don't worry about it. Matthew 16:27. One more page, okay. For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. Now that verse tells us that it's not a consistent reward, that everyone receives the same reward depending on what they've done. No, this is saying that what we do can affect what we're assigned when that day comes. We call it our calling, and that's personal. Romans 8:30 explains the process. Romans 8:30. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And notice the order here. That's different. Whom he did this is different than what we would expect it to say. Whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. What shall we say then to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? God has a plan. It's all worked out. It was determined ahead of time. When God decided to call you, he had your life course projected out. The component that we don't always know is how a person will respond. Are you going to use what you're given? There were two considerable situations that are illustrated in both Matthew and Luke. And nothing says it better. But let's go to Luke 19. We all know this passage. I won't read it all. But Luke 19, verses 13 through 25. Where he says, "And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds. And he said, occupy till I come." In other words, use this. I've given you something, use it. Thing is, when he came back, he assessed what had been done with the gift that he had given to his various servants. Pounds, in this case. Pounds were resources. When you have resources, you have the means to do something. A wealthy person can build, can help others, can support others, can do with what they've got. When you don't have it, obviously, you can't do much of anything. But pounds, in other words, resources, give people the means to do things. But in Matthew 25 is a different story. We tend to regard them in the same vein, but there's a difference there. Matthew 25. And this is a different story at a different time. And we can tell by the item that's being talked about. Verses 15 through 28. I'll start in verse 14. "For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents. To another, 2. And to another, 1. Talents are abilities. Each of us has an ability. And God can enhance that ability by giving His talent to a person. The talents give a person what they can be. It's not just what they can do, but what they can be. Unfortunately, the one who had just the one decided that the appropriate thing to do was wrap it up in a napkin and hide it away until the master returned. What we call napkin people. They draw back from assessing the faith to produce. In verse 20. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Verse 22, he also that received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you delivered unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents. Verse 23, good and faithful servant again. Verse 24, then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I know that you are a severe person, reaping where you haven't sown and gathering where you haven't strawed. What's he saying? It sounds like an insult. You make other people do your work for you. Wait a minute. I was afraid. Why would he be afraid? But anyway, he was afraid and went and hid your talent in the earth. Lo, there you have that which is thine. I'm going to give back to you without any loss exactly what you gave me. Is there any profit there? You see the issue? The unprofitable servant. His Lord answered and said unto him, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew what you should have been doing, and you didn't do it. Does that affect any of us? Are we that way? I hope not. But it's possible. We can renege on our intended response expectation. What God expects of us. We can renege on that. It's so easy to do. All we have to do is not much. Romans 8:23. I'm going to skip ahead here. Romans 8:23. Start in verse 22, for we know that the whole creation groans and travails in pain together until now. Boy, does it. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. There is an expectation. We have something coming for us. Revelation 14:4. Talks about these people. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. There is an assignment to people who are called now. We have many organizations who see themselves as so superior that they don't want their people interfacing with any other group. Is that healthy or not? It depends on the person, I suppose. someone who is weak and susceptible, it may not be a good idea. But those who are strong in the faith, who know the truth, who are exercising God's Spirit, that's a different matter entirely. In those cases, I would say we ought to be interfacing. And if we have to, confront some of the silly nonsense that's going on that puts us in the condition that we're in today. What are those conditions? What are the causes? Let me go through a few here. I'm not going to elaborate, but those of us with experience probably will recognize these things immediately. What can we identify? Well, there is an exclusivism against even identical organizations who believe exactly the same. It's just who they look to for an organizational structure. There are those groups where they exhibit a suppression of growth and service and opportunities. Someone who steps out and does something a little more than they were supposedly authorized to do. It may have been what God wanted, but it isn't what they wanted. So that person is negatively regarded, I'll put it in a mild way. There is that focus on just one particular leadership. Our group is the only group that's in the body, and all these others, who knows what. No. That's the attitude that's there in some places. And it's very detrimental to the fellowship of faith. Here's an obvious one. Failure to cultivate additional speakers. I can name you a couple of different major groups that have ministers who have to cover 3, 4, 5 congregations. And some of them hundreds of miles apart. Okay, if that's what they have to do, but we have to say, why did that situation develop? Their speakership environment was very limited. They didn't cultivate people that had the talents that God gave them. In fact, they were suspicious of those talents. I won't say any more. But another item is a disdain for like believers. There are groups that hold a disdain for others. To me, I think that's a shameful situation, but it happens. And it's something we need to get rid of. Any disdain that you have for someone else who has God's Spirit, I don't think God's pleased with that. Think what you will. Here's another big one that accounts for our condition. The organizations close down the means of evaluation. Remember what I said earlier about know them by their fruits? The way the New Testament governmental situation is structured is that there is congregational oversight. The people are to be watching what their leadership is doing. And hopefully intervene where necessary. Our congregation back east had several ministers, 5 of them I could name for you, who went off track in many important areas. We couldn't do a thing about it. And that congregation is basically destroyed after all that. But there needs to be oversight, not only from above on the people, but the people need to be evaluating the ministry for the health and welfare of the bride. That's a foreign idea in many areas, but it's in your New Testament. We also see an authority structure that protects itself over the membership. Those of you who have been in the church for any length of time would recognize many of these characteristics. Are our various groups a part of the body? There's some people who just simply don't know how to answer that. They don't like what might be the obvious answer. There's a dilemma there where there shouldn't be one. What does God expect of us? I would say there's no superior organizations at this time. We'd like to think they are. They would like to think they are. But if there were, we'd see a dynamism that we're not seeing. The difference from here on can be how we employ God's Spirit. In Revelation 3:11 it says, "Let no man steal your crown." What is that crown? It is the result of the accomplishments that you have created in your life by using God's Spirit in the way that He intends. People can steal your crown. Not that they want it themselves, they think they got their own. They just don't want you to have it. It was a danger. It existed in the early New Testament church. That's what prompted this statement. Let no man steal your crown. Let's realize, in any generation, in any situation, that is an ever-present danger.